Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. And today I have a guest from my hometown, Hamburg. It's Carlo Schilinski. And our topic for today is technology first, the science behind building successful global app and game business. Carlo, welcome.
Really cool to meet you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
So you're the founder of the App-like group. And that's, I think, the most successful digital startup ever built by a German or even European publishing house. Is that correct?
I hope so.
I mean, maybe you wouldn't agree to the fact that it's built by a publishing house, but it's built by you, like two guys as far as I know, right?
Yes, Jonas and founders. Me, exactly.
You can tell us about the story a bit more later. Maybe first tell us a bit more about your personal journey into computing, your nerd path. How did you get there where you are, and why?
Yeah, really good question. I think I got my first computer when I was 13. That was really in the early stage. I mean, computers were super slow and you had like really weird operation systems. I think my first one was Windows 3.1, 3.11, and it started really there. But I was always interested in technology, trying to figure out how stuff works, how to develop software, how to script some things. I think when I was 16, I had first websites, got a little bit into affiliate marketing and started to develop. Back in the days, it was basically HTML and PHP and super simple. When I also take a look at current technology and how it goes today, then it was really different in the past. And then after finishing high school, I went to university, studied engineering, computer science. In between, I also started already one, two companies, but that was basically not so successful. Agency for developing software and some other stuff. And then I was always getting more and more excited about this entrepreneurship. And I decided to found another company. And then I also dropped out of university because it seems to be a little bit more interesting during those days. But my focus was always on tech. So in those companies, I focused on building the software, starting the first MVPs and so on. But beside, I had always a really big interest in building businesses, because I think when you build software, it's always cool to have a meaningful reason behind. I mean, you can build software because it helps people, because it's nice code. But my purpose, I have to say that, sorry, was mainly to also make money with that somehow. And then
that's why you started with affiliate, right?
Yeah, that was, I think, back in the days, the first thing you got that got to my mind. And I did that basically. Yeah, that's right. You have also some experience with that.
I can imagine. Yeah, and you like, as you are, like App-like Group is like a very mobile oriented company. I think there's also, like, as far as I know, a lot of fraud involved in the or was, at least back in the days. Not necessarily in your company, but generally in the whole market. So I always found that market really fascinating. That it was like a coexistence when, like, people were still talking about mobile really arriving, right? And there were like people earning shitloads of money through just doing very shady things. So curious to know more about that as well later on. What was the first code you wrote yourself? Like,
in my life,
when was that?
I think it was basic HTML. And during those days, there was not even JavaScript existing. It was super simple HTML. And then what I got in touch with was PHP, then Java, C++, some C in university. Then doing PHP a little bit more professional, some more Java stuff, then got into Python, some Perl stuff, scripting, was really fascinated about Androids and starting to develop first Android apps. And now I think it's also a lot of Golang. We are using in our company most of the time Go. And that's, I think, all the programming language I'm interested in and did so far.
And right now, do you still code? And what was the last code you wrote?
It's an interesting question. In company and professional situations, I don't do it anymore. I think last time was 3-4 years ago, but I keep it up in private time. Last code in private time was this year. I built a Gradle plugin with some Kotlin, also some other stuff that was basically optimizing the build process of Android apps. But that was just a private project because I liked it. But in professional time, it's already some time ago.
Okay. A lot of CTOs tend to do home automation themselves then, like at a certain point, and annoy their family with like automating everything and having like half broken setups.
So you mean the Raspberry Pi who controls?
Yeah. Okay. And I have to admit that I have something like this at home, and my wife is really not so happy about it. But it doesn't sound as if you do that, right?
I have Philips Hue, but no custom modifications, to be honest.
Okay. So, like coming to your setup with AppLike Group.
Yes.
So you build it together with a co-founder.
Yes.
And like also my former employer, Gruner & Jahr. Like a German publishing house, and now I think you pivoted to Bertelsmann, which is like the mother company.
Exactly.
Like, why did you do it with Gruner back then? Like, how did that happen, and why?
Good question. With my co-founder together, we had a company before, and that went bankrupt. I think we lost all our private money, some money from our grandparents, and that was somehow a good experience, but also a little bit sad. And we learned the hard way that not everything works in life. And then we tried to figure out what our new path will be. And my co-founder Jonas was back then working at Gruner & Jahr, and we had a nice opportunity to do a new business with them together. I think what we brought to the table was basically some passion, some knowledge, and hopefully smart business idea that we could build in mobile, and they brought to the table basically money. So, and I think in the end, it's in life always helpful to get the right partners on board to make something successful.
But they are not like a pure digital player from my perspective, and also not a VC, right? So was it like just like this random occasion, I would say, that you kind of got together with them and Jonas was working for them, and then they equipped you and they wanted to, they picked you up, or like how did that happen?
I think it depends whom you would ask today.
Okay, I can imagine.
No, but I mean, they are really working great guys, and they also saw the potential. Not everybody at the beginning, but some of them. And we always had supporters, people that were helping us to make that happen. But of course, besides, we had to argue a lot and pitch for things and push forward. I mean, big corporates are moving most of the time slow. Big corporates don't like to do things in a different way. And those things we had to teach them somehow. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I really have to say, I'm really grateful what they did in the last couple of years and how they supported us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And now if I look at your LinkedIn profile, you have like 10 different companies, all belong to the same group. And 20, really? And like a huge setup. And it really seems to have like grown a lot. Like first, like where do you roughly stand, like employee-wise or revenue-wise, if you can tell us about that, like where you roughly stand right now?
Yeah, overall in the AppLike Group, are working around about 180 people. So I would say half of them are tech or working in content, building mobile games, mobile apps. So maybe 100 people in tech and product. And revenue-wise, we don't publish those numbers, but it's more than 100 million euros revenue a year. And growing every year by 2-digit rate. And we cannot be more happy what we're doing here in Hamburg.
Okay, yeah, cool. I mean, Hamburg is kind of a bit boring digital wise, right?
We're working with that.
Yeah. There are not so many companies supporting the local scene, and I think it's always good to hear that there's like still some left that are not leaving the sinking ship or anything.
Yeah, fair point.
And there's like also about you and you guys and a few more.
Yeah,
but not so many. So happy to count you in there. And like coming from your size to your tech stack, like what do you do with AppLike? Maybe you, like tell us a bit more about like the core purpose, and the core idea, and not about the 10 different brands that you have
sure,
there?
Sure, sure. I can try to make it a little bit simple. So we mainly do two things. The one thing is that we build and create entertaining content that can be mobile games or mobile apps that we do with two companies. And beside the main second topic is that we build technology to leverage those games and apps to grow. And you need different kind of technologies to make your mobile app businesses successful. And that's basically the setup. And to give you more examples, when you talk about tech that you need to run apps globally successful, you need to have a platform that helps you to analyze and to automate all your marketing activities. That's one thing. And the second thing is you need to have a really strong monetization platform to basically show, for example, advertisements or other things inside your apps. And that combined with the content and with the apps and games, then you would have successful business.
But to be very concrete, like Please. The first thing you built was an affiliate network or affiliate technology, essentially, where you would like you can buy app installations, and you're paying on behalf of the time that people really use the app after installing it, right?
Yes, that was one of the first thing we did. But I have to say, it was not really affiliate network because we always owned the inventory, so the apps or the supply on our own. So we were not basically rebrokering those affiliate links to other platforms. We did it also in-house all the time. But to tell you a little bit about the story. So we have started 9 years ago with one mobile app that was just available in Germany. And we have never thought about building a big ecosystem around. And on that way, we have figured out what things are required to make that successful. And we're always thinking that it's much smarter to build things in your own ecosystem, in your own company, rather than just renting software from other companies or partnering with someone, because then you basically control the entire value chain and you don't have any margin or revenues to share with someone. Mm-hmm. And to answer your question, the first app and the first project where we started with was basically a loyalty platform for mobile gamers. So you could download our app that was available on Android, and then you got different games recommended that you haven't played before. And for using those games on a daily basis, you got rewarded. And those rewards you could redeem into different vouchers. And the interesting part is here that we sold those app recommendations directly to advertisers. So we were not depending on any third-party affiliate networks, as you are naming. And that was basically the core idea around. And on the way, we figured out tons of other things. And based on that, we built other systems and other companies.
Yeah, that's really exciting to see that you grew so much. And most of your revenue most likely also doesn't come from German advertisers or from German companies.
German advertisers, I would maybe say below 2-3%, so really small. And we still do revenue in Germany, but the advertisers are normally globally, US, Europe, Tel Aviv, some Asia, South America. So overall, the market is mainly in US. So 50-60% of our revenues is from the US.
Mm-hmm. And your focus on device-wise is Android still, right?
No, or? It's both, but yeah. Android is a major share. When you think about that first business where we started 8-9 years ago, it's mainly Android, but now we have mobile games and mobile apps for iOS as well. We have different platforms, technology stacks that are used for both platforms.
Okay. And I would say then, like, if you really know like the full value chain, you're like one of the people to ask, like, if you want to start an app, like, how do you monetize it? How do you advertise for it? Like, how do you do customer acquisition and so on? And how do you make sure that you're like technically set up correctly? Is that a good assumption?
Totally right question. And I think the answer is a little bit longer, but I try to make it short. First, I think you need to have a software, you can call it like Google Analytics, that analyze how your app users are behaving. Because if you do, for example, performance marketing and you buy users for your apps or games, then you need to know how those guys are performing. Otherwise, you cannot judge if the investment into marketing was mainly right or the product features you have built are correct. And if you have that, then you would basically get in touch with some performance marketing networks. The big ones are Google and Meta, for example. And there are tons of smaller ones. And those networks helping you to acquire users by showing advertising.
So that's like first an attribution analytics setup. Is that correct? Like Adjust, for example, is one of the players that is out there. You also like have your custom technology most likely. Is that the setup you're talking about?
Yes and no. So this is half of the answer.
Yeah.
Adjust, for example, helps you to analyze and attribute your user base that you basically get from advertisement to that advertisements. And beside, it's also interesting to really have a dive deep into app user behavior. So I think I haven't used Adjust in the last couple of months, but Adjust normally offers you more features in the direction of marketing attribution, so what you were naming. But beside, you also want to know, for example, when you have a game, how many users reaching level 10, how many seconds they play in the first day, and why they're churning, what features are not helpful to your customers. And those answers you normally don't get so well in such an MMP company like you named.
But something like Mixpanel or stuff like that?
Yeah, that is good. And also you could, for example, think about game analytics. And also some people are doing that with their custom systems, like having their own Tableau dashboards, but then you have to own the data stack and do a lot of stuff. But that is basically the answer I would give as well.
Okay. And like many companies start with like an intermediary or like a layer in between, something like Segment.io or something like that. And then they push the data to a mixed panel, and then there they can analyze it, right?
Exactly right. Yeah.
Is it still like, do you guys more think in cohorts these days, or like how does it work? Like,
it depends on which question you want to answer. If you talk to business people that are interested in the overall daily KPIs, then they talk not about cohorts because they want to know how many US dollar revenue they made on what day, or how much ad spend they had, and those kind of questions. Mm-hmm. And then cohorts are not so interesting. When you do performance marketing, then you of course want to know how your users are performing that you have brought in June, comparison to users that you have brought in August. And then you cluster user groups based on time frame and timestamps into cohorts, and then you can really easily compare them, how they performing after 7 days, after 30 days, and then you take a look at KPIs like retention, how many users coming back, how much revenue those users have generated, or how many play seconds they have in the end.
Okay. And for all of that, you need like a stable identifier and a way to track users. And Apple changed a lot 2 years ago, roughly 2 years ago, when they killed the ID for advertising, right? Companies like Facebook, all of a sudden, their ad business didn't work out anymore, or not that good anymore. Like, did anything else change? And can you describe what happened there? And how you can still do advertising business?
Sure. I think also here, the question is super interesting, but we have to go a little bit into detail to give a better picture. So about the example I was talking before, like clustering users based on cohorts or the daily view, that you can normally also do without those device identifiers. Because when the install happens, then you have a connection to your backend and you can generate a user ID, and then you know always what this user basically does. So that still works. Maybe to give some examples for what those device IDs are normally used. So there are, I think, two reasons why they're helpful or why they were used in the past. One is you can identify which app installation comes on user level based on which advertisement. So if a user, for example, sees a banner ad and clicks on that, then on this click, basically, the advertisement network, which shows the banner, sends a device ID to some platform. Mainly it's an MMP, what you named before, so the software that does the attribution. And then when the installation happens, this software also collects the device ID from the app itself, and then they can match it. So basically they know which user was seeing the ad and then how they have converted in the end. That's the one reason. And the second reason is you can do really easily retargeting. So when you have, for example, a list of device IDs, for example, for Lieferando, and there you have some users that are doing a lot of shopping and ordering food, then you can see those guys again, because for every ad that is shown inside a mobile app, you see then that this device ID was trying to load an ad, and then you can basically show an ad that is bringing the person back to the Lieferando app. So this is the one idea, so to do retargeting. And the second one is, when you take a look about Meta, what you also mentioned, Meta is really strong by having user profile data. So they know about every user, what their age is, where they're coming from, what they've studied and whatever. And this they know in their own mobile application, so in the Meta app. But when then Meta, what many people are not knowing, they're showing also ads with the technology in other apps, in third-party apps. There's no like logo of Meta, but it's clear that Meta does it in background. And when they then show ads there, they want to have the same targeting options like they have in their own apps. And for that, they were heavily dependent on the device identifiers. Because then they can show also like the ads just to people that have university degree, for example. So this is basically the problem behind. And Android still has the device ID identifier. And that's the reason why Meta can still do that. But iOS decided to kill that 1-2 years ago. And they have introduced then a new technology to still allow this attribution stuff, but in an anonymized way. And the result in the industry is now that this retargeting business does not work in that fashion anymore, and Meta cannot do on iOS user behavior targeting in the end. Mm-hmm. So that's the story about that.
And how did it affect your business?
For now, I don't see any effect. When you talk about Android, it's still like it was before. And also, we are not dependent on those user-level attributions.
Okay.
That's, I think, quite positive. But maybe also to zoom out a little bit. So Apple then introduced a new technology, SK Ad Network, SCART Network, which let you still do attribution, but not on user level, but on some different dimensions in an anonymized way.
Okay.
But what's interesting is that still the way to attribute users on user level works by fingerprinting. What is meant by that? When you have a request to a server, which basically shows an advertisement, and then you have an install where you also have a request from the app, then you still have different identifiers to map users, for example, IP addresses. When IP addresses are not changing every 2-3 minutes, then you still can identify the user. So I think this still works in a certain way. So you can attribute installs to an advertisement, but Meta cannot do this big targeting over the globe with the way they did it before.
And fingerprinting is also the next topic that is changing, right? I mean, with VPNs being introduced everywhere and stuff like that, it gets harder.
Yeah.
And also like Apple and Google itself try to make it harder. Like robbing back to fingerprinting, that was also always like one topic I observed from a bit of distance. The problem when you had to use fingerprinting, like companies like Adjust and so on had to use fingerprinting to connect the normal web world with the app world, right? And that's where the magic happened. Like a few years ago, a lot of fraud was basically happening there. People trying to generate a lot of clicks, on different ads, like automatically clicking them, automatically like just redirecting on the click URLs. And then through that, like doing something like, I think it's called fingerprint stuffing or so, that they generate so many or collect so many fingerprints that they clicked on, that it's very likely that someone in the same mobile cell with like a similar IP than you has the same fingerprint and installs Uber. And through that, I think like Uber wasted kind of a lot of money for app installs that basically never happened, or even double paid or triple paid each of the app installs. Is that correct? Like first?
Yeah, it's correct, but also it has changed somehow in the last couple of years. I think 4 years ago, that was a big problem. I think there were even real industries built on top of that to make money out of those things. You can prevent that. So when it comes about to that click injection, what you were mentioning, that like a third party fires a lot of requests and then tries to steal the attribution in the end, that you can prevent. I mean, you see then that somehow the same person does that, can be the same IP address, can be different scenarios. Also, you can apply machine learning algorithm to detect those anomalous behavior. That's the one thing. And the second thing is, for iOS, it's anyway not suggested anymore to do that. So this like fingerprinting based on the click, as they have introduced their new attribution model, which also should work in the future on web. So you can then measure app installs by the Apple framework. And on Android, there's a really interesting technique, which helps you also to provide that. Because the problem is normally when the click happens, and then the user goes to the Play Store and clicks on the Insta button and then install. And then in between, somebody sends a second click, right? That is the scenario what happened. And how Google prevents that, it's really a cool, smart scenario. They give the publisher or this tracking company basically a time step when the user opens the Play Store and clicks on the Insta button. And this is then sent to the tracking provider as well. And based on that, the company can combine the two timestamps with a click timestamp. And then you don't have any option to send a second click in between and interrupt that attribution. Mm. So I think the click spamming, what was similar 5 years ago, is not really happening anymore in that fashion.
Okay. And if you would like want to build like a fraud business these days, is that still possible in the mobile world? And what would you do?
I think what I would do, I can't tell, because then maybe someone tries to do it, but it's possible, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And when you think about mobile business, app advertising business, I think there were studies out on the market that naming about 15 to 20% ad spend fraud. So this is still somehow happening, but I think it's getting much, much smarter. So it's not like that there's a stupid script that just executes clicks. I think they have then device farms, which real devices, which are not manipulated. And then maybe the scale is a little bit different, but they still can trick somehow if they want.
So Chinese device farms.
Yeah, one thing is super crazy. I just saw that some weeks ago. So there are companies who giving you some reward when you provide your phone as a VPN server to this company. And by doing that, they have really fresh IP addresses and users that are valid, basically. And then you get one to US dollars and somebody steals your connection and does shady stuff with that.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I can imagine. I have to tell you more about a few experiences I made after that. So that's still possible. But it's kind of adjusted to the desktop world, I would say, right? Where like also like a bit of fraud is happening most likely, also in real-time advertising and so on, but not as much anymore.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that is less or more than on the desktop world. I cannot judge that. I know basically that in a digital industry where somebody can earn money, there will be always fraud. That's also what the big companies are facing. That's what the smaller ones are facing. I think you have really to dedicate resources to that. Even if you are a software business or like an ad network business, whatever, you have to do that. But also when you're a small publisher, you should take a look at the users you have brought by advertising, because then you can figure out what's going on. And I would really recommend to have people in the company that have skills there and try to understand what's going on.
Okay. So coming back to like building apps and how to successfully building apps. So we started off with attribution and measurement and analytics inside your app, inside your newly built app. Like what else? Like what if you were like starting a fresh app these days, you would get, I don't know, mixed panel plus what else do you need to be successful?
Yeah, so we talked about attribution, so to figure out from which advertising users are coming, and we talked about mobile in-app analytics, so how users are behaving over time. And the third main important thing I would say is basically how to earn money. So there are two ways to do that, in-app purchases, so you can have like the option to buy some virtual items or do subscriptions, that's the one way, and the other one is ad-based. Most of the mobile games with the big reach, with the big traffic, are monetizing by digital advertising, so mobile ads. And for that, you need to have a complex tech stack to make that happen in a profitable and a good way. To give you some insights, the main ad formats that are shown in games are interstitial advertisements, so like full screen video ads that are running for 20 seconds somehow. And the second one is
basically that you can hardly prevent or hardly make disappear and so on, like with the small X buttons on top.
Yeah, you have only 10 seconds. So 10 seconds you have to watch. No, but you're right. For example, remember some weeks ago, Google changed the policy that you're not allowed, in the App Store policy, that you're not allowed to show those random videos randomly. So you have to make it after a breakpoint in the game, which is quite good for user quality. Mm-hmm. And the second one is rewarded video. What is rewarded video in comparison to interstitial? Because the ad format is basically the same, but it's different in the way how the user is interacting with that. So in some games, you have to buy something to have progress doing purchase. And the other option is to watch an advertisement, which is a rewarded video, to get a virtual game item or some progress or whatever. And that is rewarded video. And the third one is basically banner ads. So mm-hmm. seeing like a small bar down below the game.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And to make that happen, you have to get in contact and partner with some companies to show those advertisements. And what you can do is basically work here with Google and Meta. They are the market leaders in that regard. But there are also some other mid-sized companies who are doing that really successful. And interesting here is that 5-10 years ago, when the advertisement business started on mobile, it was super old school basic. So there were tons of different ad networks that had their own SDK, and those were showing advertisements inside the games. But the problem was then when there are 10 nice players that have also nice inventory or like nice advertising partners, then you need to integrate all those 10 different SDKs, which is kind of pain in the ass. And also you don't know which network derives most of the revenue for you. So you had some like rules to define.
So like yield management, you had to do manually, and you rather
exactly,
automate,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Totally, that's the point. So you had to figure out which was good in the past and then you change it somehow. Mm-hmm. And for that, some years ago, we introduced mediation platforms. So that's like software companies that are helping you to prioritize those different ad network SDKs inside your game based on historical data. So for example, they check then in US, this ad network, for example, Google, was generating an ECPM, so cost per mil, so how much you earn with an impression in the end, and compared that with other network. And based on that, you could prioritize the order which network basically wins those advertising impressions. And that was then happening 5-6 years ago and was quite successful. But there was one problem. It's kind of super stupid because you have then to check always historical data. And maybe today you have better quality users and they have higher CPMs. And then why doing it on the historical data?
Yeah, or you have like personal information about someone, and like a party is able to bid very high on
exactly.
a certain user. Yeah,
totally right. That's the point. And that was then the shift on desktop. That's already much longer happening. When you think about the desktop programmatic world, that was always decided on user level, but mm-hmm. on mobile, it was not the case in that regard. And then those mediation platforms adapting to change their logic into a bidding logic. Mm-hmm. And how is that meant? That's similar to the desktop programmatic world. On every ad impression that is shown in real time, it's decided which ad network basically wins the impression and then can load their own mobile SDK. So there's a crazy auction logic around to decide which SDK is in the end shown. And that logic was introduced like 3-4 years ago and it's now catching up, getting bigger. But still, what's weird, and also when you introduce such a software into your apps, it's still parallel existing or coexisting to those mediation layers, which is taking into consideration the historical CPMs. And that's all mixed up somehow, but it has two main disadvantages in the end. As a publisher, when you integrate that, you have always to decide which one you place where and how you change it over time, which costs a lot of overhead. And still, I think this entire solution to decide based on data which one is like winning and not on real prices that are paid for the auction or for the impression is really bad for the publishers, because based on that, just the ad networks are getting more money and not the publisher itself. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why I think the future will be that everything goes into that bidding only direction, because then the competition on the inventory is really in a fair manner.
Mm-hmm. And the publisher can decide then with which ad impressions he sells to whom, right?
Exactly. And even one step further, it's automatically done by the system, as there is an auction in place which does in real time let win the highest person in the end or the highest price.
And do you yourself own such a layer that mediates your ad impressions, or like what would you use then? Like if you build that app, you would use your own layer, I guess.
I think I don't do any advertisements for anyone here, but we have decided 1 year ago, because we are owning a lot of inventory with own games and apps, and we were never able to sell those video ad impressions to externals because we were depending on Google and Facebook. And then we decided, okay, there's somehow a weird situation in the market that mainly just those companies are earning the money, and there's no real transparency how this basic logic works. And our goal was then to think about how you can change it, to maybe build that in a more transparent way, so that every publisher who integrates such a software know because of what reason which advertising network is in the end getting the impressions. And that's the future, I think.
And is it all based on the same stack as the desktop world? It's a bit nerdy, but back when I was like working in programmatic, then there was OpenRTB and those standards, and then like Google had its own standard and so on. Is that based on the same stuff or?
Yes and no. So OpenRTB, founded by IAB, really nice protocol, super cool. Also Google works on that and many people participating. And that was introduced on the mobile side maybe 3-4 years ago when this bidding thing, which I explained before, started. But before then, this old ad network logic with SDKs was not working with that. And what they now have done, all the auction logic, so decide who basically is winning an impression, is done via OpenRTB. So this like talking to the demand side, doing the auction, deciding who wins, it's on OpenRTB. But rendering the ads in the end, so it's still done by the SDKs, by the ad network. So there's somehow like a mixture between both worlds. And I think a reason behind here is that the big ad networks, they don't want to change this because it gives a little bit power away. And OpenRTB would basically bring everybody on eye level, which maybe not everybody in the industry likes.
Really wants, yeah, I can imagine. So I think that then we can check off the monetization part. I'd be curious, like, if you would start today with your own app and your own app tech stack, what would you use? I mean, I guess it the answer is it depends, like on the use case, but like I ask myself, like, is there really a big advantage by still writing native apps these days in comparison to progressive web apps or just web apps? How do you see that? And then, like, if you went to the native route, like, where would you start these days? Would you still use like Kotlin and do it very native, or would you use something like Flutter and so on? Which route would you take?
Depending, I think, heavily on the vertical. So yeah, when it comes to mobile games, I would say 80-90%, even maybe more, percent is built with a Unity framework. So that's a really cool framework, game engine that helps you to build easily games, and that's built on C# also. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to apps, I think it depends. When you have like a big development team and you have an app where you believe it will be used for many years, then I would go with native code. But still, when you talk about Flutter, React Native, or you name it, that's pretty cool, but still has some disadvantages. And then the other question is also maybe what kind of skill set you have, ne? In the company and the employee side. So normally developers, I think, that are good, they can learn everything. That's at least my belief. But still then some people feel not comfortable by switching the technology, whatever. And that would be the reason I judge it. We have done like really cool things in React Native, Flutter not so much, one project once, but we also saw when things are getting more complicated, still native is the way to go. Huh? Mm-hmm. So that would be the way I would phrase
it. Well, if you need like hardware accelerated stuff and so on, well, these days you can even write OpenGL shaders in CSS, right? So it all got more accessible in a way. And the question is, from my perspective, like, what are the use cases where you still go native? I guess for games, obviously, because you have the Unity engine and so on. I guess you also have like 2D engines or something like that, like written in JavaScript purely. Yeah. So for games, most likely you go native. But for normal apps, would you still say that it's a good way to go? Or like you say, it depends on your team and your setup.
I think it's not a yes or no answer, depending on the team, depending how long you will develop that, how quick you have to be, what kind of like interfaces you need to know. What you were phrasing is right, of course, but still then the native part is always one step ahead. So then those frameworks are needing also some time to get then with the new features. So I'm not sure if that's like the one way or the other way is the right way to go in the end.
I think Facebook did like the first jump towards HTML like a few years ago. And then a few months later, Mark Zuckerberg personally regretted it and said like they lost billions on just using HTML in the app instead of like writing native code. I guess that is something that really changed, right? That like lots of companies, like be it delivery services, like pizza delivery services or similar, they are not doing native anymore, most likely, right? They are going progressive web app or like React Native. And
that's to be honest, for the big delivery companies, I don't know it.
Yeah.
But sometimes when you open the app, you feel a difference still. So yeah. I think it's a challenging
yeah,
one.
Yeah, yeah, obviously.
So I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know.
But is it developer specific that you feel that difference, or like does the user really feel the difference? I think it's like in the web world, you have single page web apps, right? And I'm highly skeptical these days that it still absolutely makes sense to like fully go towards that SPA direction because there are alternatives. And it means that you have to maintain like a development team for front end and one for back end. And I think with mobile, it's kind of similar, right? That like the web got much stronger and the web solutions got much stronger. And that many companies simply don't go that route, right?
Have you ever developed an app with React Native, for example?
Myself,
like a
not
demo,
really,
hello
but
world
yeah, yeah,
app, whatever
yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
So I see the benefit. For example, Flutter, I've just done Hello World. I don't know it, but for React Native, I did it. But also, like you see the pain. So it's like, oh, like the JavaScript people that will maybe correct me and can be, yeah. But when you build then an app with Kotlin and Android Studio, it's like, it's a different experience. So I wouldn't say that the native way is the wrong way to go because you have for sure some advantages. So.
Okay. Yeah, I can imagine. And especially if you want to like have like a very fast and reactive application, then most likely it's still needed, right? But
that's right.
Like it most likely depends on the use case, right?
One thing for React Native, for example, we're doing that for some mobile apps. You can really easily update things also when the app was deployed to the App Store because you can then later change the JavaScript side in real time. And that is, of course, a really nice feature. But also then here, the App Store provides you real-time updates or in-time updates, and then it's also more convenient for the app developers. So I think it's not black or white.
Okay. What about coming back to monetization a bit, like
sure.
The whole world of in-app purchases got pretty big, right? In the last years. Is there like also a lot of gray market happening there and a lot of gray stuff happening there, or
you mean in regards of fraud?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Maybe like I have never done or seen that, to be honest. Also, we are not so strong in the in-app purchase market. But what you have to keep in mind, the only thing that you really can do there from a like broader perspective is that you have some fake accounts with stolen credit cards. And when you have that, then you can basically do purchases. And then maybe some months or weeks later, the purchase will be denied and then the publisher doesn't get any money from the big tech companies.
So, Carlo, I have a very concrete use case for you. As you know, I run this grown conference, OMR, with 70,000 people coming to Hamburg once a year. And to be honest, like from my perspective, like most conferences and events really struggle with their app. It's like really shitty. Like if you look at like Web Summit in the App Store, they have like really shitty reviews. It like applies to my app as well. If I would now call you a few months before the conference and ask you to give me like a hint which setup to pick for my concrete use case, what would you do?
Maybe two questions before I answer. How much time do we have to build it?
2 months.
Do we have already some developers?
Yes.
Okay, what kind of?
Mostly web.
Okay. I think that's helping a lot. if you will want to be fast and you don't have requirements for features that have a lot of interfaces, connections to other frameworks, APIs, whatever, and you just want to show info or content that helps to advise customers somehow, then I would go here with a hybrid solution, maybe more in favor of React Native than, mm-hmm. than Flutter, mm-hmm. because I still believe even if Flutter catches up a lot and has some big hype in the development community, React Native, for my taste, is more mature in a way that it offers you more libraries and more different features. And when you are then having those web people already, I think the transition to help them to build that is quite easy.
But you wouldn't still go with like a framework like React Native and not build something which is mostly web-based or more web-based?
From my experience, you still feel a little bit difference when you have like a React Native app versus an application inside the browser.
And you can use the Bluetooth stack and stuff like that. If you want to do indoor navigation, something like that, you can still use that, right?
Some beacons overwear and NFC and whatever. So
would you do that? Would you use that?
I would use it.
Okay.
But yeah, I trust also OMR. So.
And then obviously you would recommend like your dedicated marketing stack and so on, I assume.
Maybe we can
and
have
something
talk.
For measurement.
So. Why not?
Yeah, for measurement, would you then use something like Mixpanel, or I guess you also have your solution, right?
We have a solution that really can cover many needs in that regard and open to talk about that. But I think it's not about advertising. Also here, depending what you're aiming for, when you have a small app business that really is individually or located or like just in one city, then go or take something that is easy and just covers your need. Mm-hmm. You don't don't need to build everything here. But when you are a gaming company that wants to scale to 100, 200 million of users, then you need a totally different stack in the end.
Okay, thanks a lot. So then we're slowly coming to the outro. And I still have a complicated question for you where I look forward to the answer. What was the best management advice you ever got?
This is a good one. I think I didn't have one person who gave me advice, but I had listened to some talks from famous people in the tech industry in the US. And for me, it's basically found every team or every company in the digital industry with tech people on eye level with business people. So I really think you need both. In a reason of like how your happiness of your people will be, how successful a product will be, and how successful a company in the end is. I really think when you try out a product that is built by business people in a way that they decide what was happening, then you have not the same result like you would have when tech people are involved. When you just let the tech people do it alone, then of course you don't have a product that anyone uses.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just nice code, also cool, but doesn't help someone.
Yeah.
So I think
it's
a mixture. But I really think when you take a look at some SaaS companies that are really built by business people, then you miss this like excitement about the product. And it's just efficiency and it's not a cool nice product.
That's heaviness, right? Or if you look back, like back in the zeros in Germany, it was very popular that two guys or women coming from WHU, the famous university here, just were looking for a tech co-founder, right? To give them like, I don't know, 2% of the company and see.
But that's toxic. Yeah. So I think it's not about to get the tech people on board to build what you want to do. It's about to listen to their thoughts because they have different perspectives and that drives in the end a good business, but also a good product. So I really think that's important. When I take a look at our teams and our companies, we really have in every team a tech lead, but also a product lead. That should basically be always on eye level and they should decide together.
So interdisciplinary teams with developers, product people, and everyone working together, right?
Yes.
Business side as well, which is something that I still rarely see. Like in lots of companies, you have tech, maybe even tech and product joined in one unit. And then you have the business organization in parallel to that, right?
I would lie if we do not have the same problem. So this is like what you describe as in every digital startup or company in the end. But you can do a lot of things to basically release that and improve that. For example, what we do, we really want to have features that we build connected to the business people. You can achieve that by, for example, have some sessions where tech people showing to business what they have built. That tech people also from like the normal employees can go to other business people and they can describe their needs or their problems. And when you have that, then the culture will really collaborate and have more output in that regard.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. That was a good hint. I mean, still, it's very easy to do it in a wrong way, right? Still these days, and I see it in lots of companies. And I guess like for you, it's maybe also the same that it's like back and forth. But I believe that it's really important to be close to.
I mean, nobody does everything perfect. It's like part of life to fail. But I think the most important part is then when you see something that goes wrong, that you at least don't do it twice wrong. So that you then repeat and try to do things better.
So last question from my end, like that device there on the table, you see it?
Yes.
It's a little surprise for you. It's a time machine that can now help us travel back in time. And we have the chance to jump to the year 2014, which was the year when you guys met or just started with Applike, I think. We now travel back in time and observe yourself for a little while. And you now have the chance, like you sit there coding and Jonas is also like doing his part of the game. You now have the chance to whisper something into a young Carlos' ears. What would it be?
It's also a nice one. I think it would not be related to technology. When I take a look at the technology in the last 8 years, we did something slow. Sometimes we started too late. That happened. But overall, I'm pretty proud about what we have, the tech stack, the people, and how we do things. I would give myself the advice to think bigger already earlier. So I think it's also a German problem. We always think, maybe you have the same idea, that we are not like, it's not okay to do that and this. And this I also had in my life sometimes. And mm-hmm. when we were starting 8, 9 years ago, I never thought about what we have now that would be achievable. But if I would have this proudness and being like kind of confident 8, 9 years ago, then I would have maybe already now achieved with the team much more than we now have. And I think that's also the mindset that we really need more in Germany, because when you compare to US, where everybody thinks about like what costs the world, we can do this and that, and we are tomorrow the kings, then of course your mindset to growth is different. So I think that would be the advice I would give to myself.
Thanks a lot, Carlo. It was a good advice. And yeah, I absolutely agree that it's very sad to see so many companies coming from the German market really focusing on the German market. Like in other smaller companies like Israel, for example, you see like people going international straight away and thinking big straight away. And I think that's like a missing in the German DNA, because like our country is just big enough to do good business here, right?
I think we really cannot be lazy in the next 10, 20 years. We have a lot of stuff to do. It's a really fair point. And when I take a look also on competitor companies in Tel Aviv, Israel, they are really doing well.
Yeah.
And we are not allowed to fall asleep here. So we have to work hard.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Let's do that.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah. Pleasure too. Bye.
Ciao.
Thank you for listening to the Alphalist podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. Alphalist is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphalist.com. Send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on Alphalist, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.